You're listening to Understanding the Political Environment and the Anticipated Impact on Risk Adjustment. In short, it's complicated. Presented by David Smith with Lovett Partners. This session was presented February 2017 at the Risk Adjustment Value Visit.
Kristen, thank you. The other reason for not doing slides is, and Kristen, you kind of referenced this, is that things are changing at just such a frenetic pace right now that anything that I would do would be out of date by the time I got here and put it up on the screen, and it would be out of date again by the time we were done with our discussion. Things are changing rapidly. So I'll invite any of you that are on Twitter to go ahead and just pull that up. And if anything's happening over the course of the talk, just raise your hand and we'll keep this really dynamic and really fluid. I want to start just by maybe characterizing. We're going to cover, I think, three things over the course of my time with you this morning. And I would definitely invite you to raise your hand, ask questions, make observations. We can have this really interactive. And I think we'll have some time at the end. And I know I would be well served and interested in your read in the environment, particularly what you were assuming and observing before you walked into the room this morning. If anything that I said changed that, would be interested in your thoughts. Let me also just introduce a colleague of mine in the back of the room, Sean Mullen, who's a senior director for us at Lovett Partners and leads a practice area on insurance market reforms. We enjoy a close relationship with Kathy and Dennis and Kristen and the Health Plan Alliance, and grateful for the invitation to be here. I'm going to talk a little bit about the political environment. I'm going to talk about some of the policy implications that we see for some lines of business. I want to talk just a little bit about premium stabilization programs, particularly risk adjustment, recognizing that's a bit of a wonkier issue that is not at the top of the political policy hit list at the moment, but give just a bit of a recount on what happened last year, some of what drove that, and what could happen this year. We'll go from there. On the front end of this, let me just make two observations that I think maybe start to tee up the discussion. Like many of you, on the morning of November 9th, I was watching the TV with great interest and different sets of emotions, and I watched the president-elect stand up and give his speech, and then the next day we watched everybody react to it. And you saw the typical reaction. People said, what an incredible thing, Americans, this transfer of power. We need to get behind the new president. We need to support him. We need to give him the benefit of the doubt. But one of the things that really has stuck out to me was Paul Ryan. And he gave a speech, and when he commented on the outcome of the election, he declared this unified Republican Party that now finally had this ability to implement a conservative agenda and his Better Way plan and the things that he's been working on as a policy wonk for years. Let me just make really clear to you, nobody expected the result of November 9th, save a few folks that I think were probably even surprised they were right. This was a very unexpected for Republicans, and they weren't ready to walk into this environment. What was interesting about that notion of a unified Republican government is that it requires some degree of reconciliation within policymakers. And what we knew then is what we know now, and what we continue to see playing out is that there are some really powerful factions within the party that are at war with each other. And it has slowed this process down a lot. And I'm just going to list out the four factions, and then I'm going to talk through eight different points of fact, eight different things we're observing that don't give us a clear sense of what's happening, but begin to give us some data for where we might be heading. Faction number one in this framework is what I'll call the Pence, Price, Walden faction. Greg Walden is the new chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives. Pretty powerful, all very aligned with Paul Ryan. Pence, the vice president, has had pretty significant deference from the president, both in picking HHS folks. Seema Verma from Indiana is a great example. Tom Price was a great example of that. And Pence and Paul Ryan and Greg Walden all sing from the same sheet of music. They all see policy the same way. They are ideologically consistent. The bills that Tom Price put forward last year, Paul Ryan's Better Way plan that looks at things like portability, HSA expansion, changes to Medicaid, these are all things they're well aligned on. But it's not traditional Republican orthodoxy. But if you look at it, this is the one set of plans and priorities that seem to be somewhat consistent among most Republicans. That's faction one. Faction two is the antithesis of that, and it's the Senate Republicans, who, for their part, are becoming more reticent by the day to do anything big. And there's some warring going on within Senate Republicans I'll talk just a little bit about. But they've gone on record at not wanting to do anything significant with Medicare, nothing significant with Medicaid, and to be somewhat slow and steady about any changes to the Affordable Care Act. So you know, and you probably already do, Senate Republicans have a majority, but it's a slim majority, which means they can get something done through reconciliation, budget reconciliation, which is a really wonky, terrible, rarely used budget process that passed the ACA and that could also repeal major parts of the ACA. But to do anything on the basis of replacement, unless they go back to reconciliation, which has strict rules, they need 60 votes, which means they need 8 Democrats to cross lines, and they need to retain their Republican majority. You'll recall maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago when, I guess almost a month ago, when Barack Obama and Vice President-elect Pence went to the Hill and they were talking about their disparate strategies, you had right out of the gates 3 or 4 Republicans start to defect on the notion of repealing and replacing, or repealing and then replacing. And that tells you how fragile that 52 Senate Republican majority is. So that's faction two. Faction three is what I will call, it's the House Liberty Caucus. It's the Tea Party. It's the vestige of that movement that is very anti-Obamacare, wants to blow up the system, wants to fire a missile at the law. And although their influence has waned over the course of the last 6 or 7 years, they are still influential. Paul Ryan still has to reconcile their disparate interests with the mainstream of the party. They still have the ear of major policy groups like the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and they still make a lot of noise, and that's got to be reconciled. And the fourth faction is a one-man faction, and Donald Trump, whose influence is starting to wane, not because of matters on health care, but his relationship and the confidence of the Congress and the president has seen a bit of an unprecedented erosion over the course, particularly of the last 3 weeks. Again, other items, we don't have to get into the immigration bill and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or what's happening with Michael Flynn. But that erosion matters in the healthcare policy debate because Donald Trump, on January 20th, had a really big finger to put on the scale. We've all watched this tweeting dynamic, which we all know is really interesting and fascinating, and even a little humorous when you stand back and you start to kind of joke about it. But it's significant because when he tweets something, it freaks out the markets and policymakers, and everybody responds in a pretty unprecedented way. He has a big finger, but that finger is only as heavy as the confidence he has of the Congress, which again is waning. So these are the four factions. And the reason I lay this framework out and the reason this intra-party reconciliation is such a critical component to this discussion is that anything that happens from a policy perspective has to sit somewhere in the middle of those four groups. They're all going to have different weighted points of interest, but you'll have to see some degree of reconciliation within those political factions. Yeah. Yeah, so the question was the I'm going to rephrase it just a little. Tell me if I'm butchering the question, but the question I think is the evolution of the potential for bipartisan support with Democrats and the folks that are up for re-election in 2018 and how they're seeing this. Look, I think going into January 20th, I can tell you factually that leaders in the House and major committee leaders in the Senate fully acknowledged the need for bipartisan support. And when we canvassed Democrats on the Hill, we had a sense that there was a willingness, as long as the administration and the Republicans weren't going to willfully subvert the Affordable Care Act, that they would cross party lines and work. That being said, there's a dynamic with the 2018 midterm elections that's important, and that's that Democrats are geographically and politically in a much better position, in a much weaker position than Republicans. And this really, Kathy, becomes a matter of which way the ACA winds go. And I'm going to talk about that in the timelines in just a second. If popular support for the ACA and leaving the ACA in place as is today remains, and you see this other dissonance and a loss of the electorate and the confidence of the administration, you'll see Democrats continue to pull back. This will be an incredibly partisan issue. Nothing's going to get done. If something can get done over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, and it's not a major structural change to the law, but it's done in a series of sidecars, I'll explain to you what that means in a couple of minutes, then I think you can get some bipartisan support. The other thing, Kathy, and I'll comment on this in a minute, is that there's 4 mandatory legislative health care events this year. This is must-pass legislation, which gives you 4 vehicles in which you'll have to have Democrats cross party lines if you're going to get this done, things like CHIP reauthorization. So that creates a window for this also. Anything big tent, and I'd call big tent the equivalent to that, would be like the first time we passed the Affordable Care Act, or not the first time, when we passed the Affordable Care Act, whatever this was, 8 years ago. It's going to be harder to get bipartisan support. Things that kind of sneak under the radar, you can get some business done. Let me run through just a series of things we're observing now. So those are our factions. That's the framework I want to use. I want to talk through just 8. I'm not going to call them facts. I'm going to call them observations. And if we kind of take these 8 observations, we start to get a sense for what's happening in policy and what might be potential to emerge. First point is that the Trump administration is seeking market stability for 2018 to some degree. On November 9th, I can remember, and the 10th, I can remember canvassing folks in D.C. These were the plan associations and the hospital associations, and there was an instant almost panic that one of the first things that the Trump administration would do was change the structure of the cost-sharing reduction subsidies and threaten to not pay out reinsurance. And to their credit, the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association hired some folks that gave them tremendous access to the transition team and aggressively and vigorously pursued an agenda that not only would not see that, but potentially would instill some mechanisms within the individual market and CMS's administration of it that could potentially restore some of the confidence of plans in the market. Well, yesterday we saw the proposed rule. We heard 2 weeks ago that a rule had gone over to OMB. All we knew about the rule was that it was titled Market Stability. We didn't really know what was in there. We kind of got a leaked version of it a few days ago. And we saw the final rule yesterday. And this is nothing that's incredibly revelatory, but it's a strong signal that this administration is not going to fire a missile at the market directly. They're also not going to do a lot to drive enrollment and try to bring vast amounts of people, and we saw that at the end of this last open enrollment period. And with this proposed rule, the biggest things that are suggested in it is a tightening of the enforcement of the special enrollment periods and a tightening of the open enrollment window. October 1st to November 15th feels a bit more like Medicare Advantage. And there was a rumor that they were going to put some language in around some moderate expansion of the age banding 1 to 3.49 or 3.49 to 1, and a couple other things that might stabilize the market. They've left that out of the proposed rule. They could come back and revisit in the final. The other thing about this proposed rule is it has a really quick timeline for comments, which means they're wanting a final rule out, hopefully in time for plans to go through the rate and form filing process within their states. They'll miss some states, of course. But for plans to be able to price for 2018. We're going to talk a little bit about how plans are reading that, and I'd be interested in your thoughts. There's other things that this administration could potentially do that might continue to strengthen the law. There's things related to third-party payments. We've heard a lot about that. There's grace periods. Hard to imagine another year where a Trump administration facilitates open enrollment on healthcare.gov. So it's conceivable there's going to be changes to the enrollment platform that the administration uses. There could be changes to premium stabilization programs. I know a topic of great interest to you that we'll talk a little bit about. There's other things that the administration can do. But again, I think the punchline here is that so far as we can observe, both on its face and in our conversations with the administration, is that there is no active element to subvert the law. At least at this point. Tom Price just obviously took the chair, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Number 2, talked a little bit about the president and the big finger that he has to put on the scale, that he's not really put on the scale yet. So he's done this with pharma, and every time the Affordable Care Act comes up in a public setting, you can time the commentary on it to 40 seconds about. And typically, he has vacillated from, we have a plan, and it's ready, and it's great, and as soon as I've got price in place, I'm going to show it to you, to, geez, you know what? This is pretty heady stuff, and I don't think we're going to get anything done until 2018. This is kind of more the end of the spectrum that we're on right now with the current administration. It's a little at odds, and I'll reference this in a moment. It's a little at odds with the Congress with respect to timing, but the administration has said this is complicated, and we don't know that we're going to have a solution until 2018. The Trump administration has also not had an active public meeting with the insurance industry. You saw Pharma and Steve Eubel, the head of Pharma, meet with the president himself and senior officials a couple weeks ago in Washington. That was significant because of the derision the pharmaceutical industry has attracted and because Donald Trump himself has come out and put his finger on the scale there. Donald Trump has not met personally with the insurance industry, at least in a public setting. But, again, folks like BCBSA, AHIP, and others in town do have the ear of transition officials and now have the ear of Tom Price by virtue of different points of access. If and when Donald Trump puts his finger on the scale, this could become fairly material. Again, I would caution you just to watch the general confidence in the president and the degree to which that can be influential. Number three, Tom Price is confirmed, but he's going to take time to activate. I'm trying to think of how a person in D.C. on Tuesday characterized it. It's a train wreck. It's a bit of a disaster right now. And you typically have this when you transition officials, right? You have an interim person that's kind of really just keeping the trains running on time, but there's no direction. But you have a couple of new factors that really have emerged in this particular case. You have a bit of a fractious confirmation process for Tom Price that I would say in the course of normal political theater and the normal confirmation process would have probably been harder for him to get through. The scrutiny that he drew for some of the financial activity when he had congressional and budgetary stewardship did not get a lot of attention, and it was passed along party lines. So you're already starting at a bit of a credibility disadvantage with Democrats and with career staff at HHS. The other dynamic that you have is that if you think of being a career staff, and as a career staff, you're non-political. So that means you can't really take a side, but you've also spent 8 years of your life implementing the Affordable Care Act. And you've been drinking the Sebelius, Burwell, Slavitt, Tavner Kool-Aid, that this is a good thing for America, and this is a great work, and we're helping people. And then a new HHS secretary comes in and says, it was terrible, and it's ruined the economy, and it's ruined healthcare. That kind of morale that sits within the organization becomes difficult to reconcile. You further complicate that with the fact that this is an agency, this is a department, with a multi-trillion dollar budget. Tom Price is not going to have a lot of time to play politics in the first few days. And that matters because he's going to come in and he's going to have a very managerially oriented role, at least in the initial days. He's not going to be able to dive deep into policy. I think there was some evidence of that, actually. And the other thing that he has to do is he has to add a series of appointments. There's a lot of staffing at HHS. The Office of the National Coordinator, huge rule with 21st Century Cures that they have to implement. We don't have a national coordinator. OCR, FDA, there's all other agencies that we need posts and we need leadership on, and we need it quickly. One of the points of evidence of this is that Tom Price, Secretary Price, visited the Republicans at their weekly lunch. And this was interesting if you were kind of watching this. Republicans kind of thought, we're going to see this side of the Donald Trump spectrum. We're going to hear what this plan has been because we've been waiting for you, Secretary Price, to get confirmed. And he didn't say anything. He really didn't have a message from the president about a plan to repeal and replace. Tells you again that the administration's not sure what to do. Dr. Price, Secretary Price, strong viewpoints, strong policy person, very pro-privatization of Medicare, very anti-Affordable Care Act, and will definitely play his part in unraveling the law. He just may not be as influential in the early stages of this as folks may have thought. Also, just a lot of things happening at CMS right now. You've got MACRA is in its implementation. Show of hands, who knows what MACRA is? Okay, great. MACRA is, I'll just quick description. Big change to the way Part B payments are made through Medicare starting in 2019. A significant law that's associated with these alternative payment models and value-based reimbursements. Tons of infrastructure has got to get built for that. That's going to monopolize a lot of his time also. So that's, again, just another data point. Okay, observation number four. Yeah, please. Do we think MACRA is going to happen? The answer is we do. It was passed on a bipartisan basis. You're not going to go back to the SGR that it replaced. And you don't get consensus, bipartisan consensus on a lot of things, but you've got consensus on fee-for-service is the enemy. Coordinated care is better than uncoordinated care, and if it's scorable, it's good. And MACRA checks all of those boxes. I will tell you that the final rule, the final 2,700-page rule, is difficult, and for smaller practices, this has become a burden. And so I could definitely see changes in the timeline, things that would promote commercial alternative payment models instead of CMS-driven alternative payment models to speed up that recognition. Yep. Yeah, so I'll repeat the question. Next question is bundled payments. Anything mandatory? Dr. Price, he doesn't lie. He's an orthopedic surgeon. Comprehensive care for joint replacement was the first mandatory bundle out of the gates. Wasn't a popular thing. Strong feeling from Dr. Price that CMMI, so CMMI is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. This is a group that's given kind of a 10-year budget to do really unique things in changing and introducing Medicare-based demonstration projects in the market. Mandatory bundles are one of them. We could see a rolling back of those. We could see a softening of the timelines. We could see a softening of the risk. Hard to tell if he would just try to strip it from the economy generally, because on the other side of this, he's generally a fan of bundles, particularly anything that's voluntary. So the bundle payment for care improvement, BPCI, you would see that continuing forward and strengthening. That program has some different problems, but bundles definitely continue in our view. Number four, remains significant dissonance between the administration and the Congress on timing and substance. I referenced this just a little bit already, that we're a little bit far apart on time. And I'll go back to the factions notion here for just a second. You've got the House chair, the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who said, look, it's got to get done by the end of the year. You've got the president saying it's going to be early next year. You've got the Senate saying, gee, it could actually be a little bit longer. And then the effectuation for this stuff could actually be 2 or 3 years to operationalize, to change the rules for IRS, to change the way subsidies work, the exchanges, the data services hub, anything else of that nature. We've started hearing a little bit more consensus around the notion of, and you saw Paul Ryan try and debunk this on the day of the Super Bowl, that it's, look, it's not it is repeal and replace, it's not repeal and repair, but the subtext to this really is it's repeal and repair. It's keeping the core statutory framework of the Affordable Care Act in place. But it's making changes that are kind of Republican, and it's selling it as a Republican plan. And you'll recall, you've probably heard this a lot over the last few years, that look, most of the stuff that's in the Affordable Care Act for 20 years, these are Republican ideas. The notion of exchanges and a subsidy structure and the like. So you'll see a lot of that come through. Other things that have strong consensus in Republican circles right now, we can talk a little bit more about this later on, high-risk pools, not necessarily going back to the states for funding, but being federally funded, health savings accounts being attached to any statutory framework that would be a mechanism to try to drive consumerism. We're still hearing talk about portability, this notion of crossing state lines. I haven't seen any legislative text, policy text that makes, somebody's going to prove me wrong on this someday. I just don't see how that ever gets through the Congress in a meaningful way, and how states have consensus on that. But generally, there's still some strong dissonance as to the structure of what would come through in a repeal and replace. Congress still is expressing the end of the year, and I'll talk about the timelines for just a minute. Number five, slow and steady wins the race for Senate Republicans. There's a bit of a feud taking place within the Republican Party right now. There's and it's a feud of jurisdiction. You have two committees within the Senate that really have material stewardship over these issues. You have Senate Finance, which is led by Orrin Hatch, and you have the Senate Help Committee, which is led by Senator Lamar Alexander. Lamar Alexander has gone on record over and over again as being a pragmatist, very pro taking this slow. He's used the language of repair instead of replace, doesn't want to touch Medicaid, doesn't want to touch Medicare. You have others in the Senate that believe they have more jurisdiction than Lamar Alexander, but that's beginning to set up a little bit of a fight between finance and between help. And a dynamic that becomes important when you think about preserving that 52-vote strong majority within the Senate. Again, you've seen some senators kind of start to crack in the weeks since, and Republicans are going to be thinking pretty seriously about their reelection prospects. The further out you push this debate into this year, into early next year, you start running into an electoral cycle that gets wider every 2 years. It becomes difficult if we try to pass something at the end of the year. But number six, congressional timeline will drive action. So let's talk about a few of the things that could drive action. Two really big dates coming up right now. March 23rd, 8th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act. That's meaningful because it's going to attract a lot of attention. And from the folks it's going to attract attention from, you're going to have folks on the left that are going to say, look at what a great thing this has done, the lives that it's saved, all the good that it's done. And then it's going to get kind of the Republican base and the pundits to stand up and say, why haven't we done anything about this yet? They're going to look and say, we had a promise that on day one it was going to be a repeal and a replace and we were going to have a new system. And now it's the 8th anniversary. What are you doing, Republicans? That's going to put pressure back on Republicans. On its heels, you have the start of the Easter recess on April 16th. Any of you watch the Jason Chaffetz town hall clips from a few weeks ago? You're going to see that all over the country. But you're going to see that come from two sides. You're going to have folks on the left that are going to be crashing these town halls, very much like what we saw with the Tea Party 8 years ago and what we saw with Chaffetz, that are going to be very pro-Affordable Care Act and any other issues that are taking place at the time. And then you're going to have folks at the right saying, what in the heck are you doing? Look at everything Donald Trump is doing. Look at all he's done in the 3 months he's been elected, and you haven't done anything in the Congress. That puts significant pressure. And when you have the combination of that kind of political pressure and then that kind of power, unusual things could happen. And so I'd be watching those dynamics play out over the next few weeks. You have four legislative events that have to take place between now and the end of the year. So if you take those political dynamics and now we overlay it with everything else I've shared in these four must-pass events, you've got the CHIP reauthorization, which is controversial. It's been controversial for the last few years, and this is it's not an insignificant policy area by itself, and it deals very strongly with Medicaid financing. You've got the user fee assessments. This is on the medical device, pharma, biopharma, biotech industries. These are negotiated every few years. They were negotiated by the Obama administration. They'll be enacted by this Congress. They could be renegotiated. They still have to be passed. That could be a vehicle in which legislation gets done. You've got a series of Medicare extenders at the end of the year that have to get passed. And you've got a debt ceiling debate, which will be raucous in its own right and starts to pull on Faction 3 quite a bit. Those are four must-pass legislative events. And then throughout all of that, again, you have this notion of repeal through reconciliation and potentially replace, which could ride alongside any of those or could be associated with that. Just to talk a little bit about that main event, it was kind of believed, so this has been the evolution of this. We would repeal and then we would replace. And then it was, well, we'll repeal and replace, and we'll do that through reconciliation. And now the narrative has become, well, we will repeal and replace through reconciliation. We're going to do it in a soft way. It's going to be a bit ceremonious. But then there's going to be a series of what's called sidecars, little attachments to those four legislative events that might change the age banding, might change premium stabilization, might change grace periods, enrollments, the nature of the exchanges, 1332 waiver structures for states to modify and do their own thing. So those sidecars is really where we think the big policy gets done and this big event becomes significant, because if the big event, to go back to Kathy's point, really chases off that notion of bipartisanship, these four legislative must-pass events become very hard to get done and you don't see any sidecars show up in them. Number seven, meaningful substantive reforms come through repeal and replace through reconciliation sidecars. I just talked about that, so I'll skip over it. And number eight, probably the big one here, is that bipartisan consensus will be critical. This does go back to what Kathy said, but becoming increasingly difficult in this current environment. Today, or it was yesterday, we saw a reconciliation repeal and replace bill go over to the Congressional Budget Office. So we're going to see some finances come out of this before too much longer. But we definitely have to see an environment where eight Democrats will cross party lines for anything substantive to get done in the market. Let me just share one other observation before I get to kind of the policy implications here. And this is really, it's kind of developed over the course of the last couple of days as we've been in earnings seasons for managed care companies. We obviously saw the mergers blow up this week, and then we saw Humana come out and say, we're pulling out of the other, I think, 11 markets that we're in. Mark Bertolini yesterday, CEO of Aetna, at a Wall Street Journal breakfast in New York, said Obamacare is in a death spiral. That's not an exactly optimistic-inducing expression. And then you had Dr. Mario Molina on his earnings call yesterday basically say the same thing, threaten to pull out of the market. And by the way, for the first time we've heard this year, cited risk adjustment as a major problem, as an ongoing problem. We haven't heard that from Bertolini or the typical cast of characters. We did hear it from Dr. Molina yesterday. That's becoming kind of a growing consensus in the market. Now, you'd kind of expect that a little bit, right? You'll have the health insurance industry stand up and say, look, we were good soldiers. It's been a difficult market for us. We've lost a lot of money. We have no idea what you're going to do. We have no predictability. And you want us to price in this environment? Are you crazy? And so that's a little bit of that saber rattling. But at the same time, there's a very real threat that you could see major counties or parts of the country that don't have any participating plans in 2018 becomes a significant problem for Republicans, because at one point or another, either induced by time or events, Republicans are going to have political ownership for this thing. And when that happens, again, that starts to induce maybe some irrational behavior. So I'm going to pause there just on the political landscape for a minute. I know that's a lot because there's a lot happening. I'll jump into the policy stuff and then we'll go into premium stabilization. But any questions or thoughts or comments? Yeah.
So yesterday, or maybe it was the day before, we also saw that the IRS has decided, yeah, we're not going to do anything with the individual mandate anymore. And so that's sort of, you know, coming on the heels of the same day where they put all these market stabilization stuff in the rule. You know, what's the sense of what is the administration trying to do and trying to accomplish by having these things that seem to be at odds to me?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's not purely reconcilable. I will tell you, I don't have perfect information on that decision. What we think has happened is that the IRS is abiding by an executive order. And the executive order, I guess this is another data point, the executive order said, hey, to all agencies, make this thing a little less complicated and a little less problematic for Americans. And I think the IRS looked at that and they pulled back, probably by virtue of Pence or Priebus or somebody in the administration. I would tell you that I think they'll look to claim a political victory on that at some point. But that we don't perceive this as being something that's willfully subverting the law. I think most people kind of acknowledge that the individual mandate probably isn't doing a ton to build strong risk pools by itself. And it's not going to be a surprise that Republicans are going to ditch the mandate and probably go to something like continuous coverage or stronger enrollment windows to try and strengthen instead of using that as an effort. So it's something to watch for sure, but we don't see it as threatening.
Where do they stand on the subsidies on the individual coverage on the public exchange?
Yeah, there's a wide variation. I'll talk a little bit about Medicaid here in just a second. But most of the plan, if you inventory most Republican plans, Kathy, they compressed the subsidy structure from 400% FPL being the high point to about 250 to 300%. And so I think you could see that. I think that's where they'd get some pay force out of anything else they try and do in the law, repealing the taxes that they need to repeal. The other thing that you're hearing a lot of talk, and McConnell said this, it was yesterday or Tuesday, there's becoming increased support for this high-risk pool notion. So basically bifurcating high-risk pools from the core individual market risk pools, continuing to subsidize folks that would buy into the individual risk pool, some federally funded match program for the high-risk pools, and then trying to build the model off of what Minnesota or Wisconsin did a few years ago.
And the essential benefits package, I mean, that's been one of the other things with insurers that some people would just like to buy a catastrophic and sort of a stripped-down version. Is that
very much on the table, reducing the degree of standardization. Our current thinking right now is you'd see a couple of elements. You would see a restructuring of the amendment through repeal and replace of the law that would basically allow for much greater flexibility as administered by the feds or as deferred to states than we currently see today. You wouldn't see as many stringent requirements associated with the EHBs or actuarial values. And through 1332 waivers, you would see the Congress really try to also give that authority back to states, recognizing states do have that authority under the ACA, but there'd be kind of more optionality and flexibility. That also gets to Medicaid, where we're seeing kind of the same thing with 1115 waivers for anybody that follows that part of the market. We don't see block grants. It'll be sold as block grants. That's kind of that's the narrative. But we would see per capita spending caps for expansion populations. That would be the financing mechanism for reducing some of the expanded FMAPs for the expanded populations, inducing the states that didn't expand and providing some per capita spending caps for folks that would fit in that range. Probably still goes up to about 133%. Maybe some tinkering with the base FMAP rates, but boy, you'll be picking a fight with governors if you do that, and you've got a lot of Republican governors you don't want to pick a fight with. So Medicaid marginal changes, we don't see a scenario where you block grant the whole program. Again, see Faction 2. Senate Republicans just aren't going to sign up for that.
So I have two questions. First question, any update on risk corridors? And what's going to happen with that? Because I got a big payout receivable that should be coming to us. And my leadership wants to know when it's coming. They said, make sure to come back and report.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't have an answer, but there's two obviously really big data points. One, you're probably all familiar with the MOTA lawsuit the other day. And then the other, you might not be as familiar with. So MOTA, which is a health insurance plan in Oregon, along with a bunch of other folks, filed suit for the right to this this money. And this went to all 12 of these are at the it's the Federal Court of Appeals, who has jurisdiction, and a very eclectic set of judges on this group. But Judge Wheeler, in this case, ruled in favor of MOTA. It's the first time this has happened. I think Land of Lincoln was overturned. I think there was one other that was kind of thrown out. But this is significant because this now can kind of breach and get to the District Court of Appeals, which means it's on a path to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court can weigh in. And the basis, obviously, of the argument, the administration has made an argument in all 12 of these cases that, look, we never said we weren't going to pay it. We just said we can't pay it yet. And by the way, it has to be a budget-neutral program. Well, Judge Wheeler's read of the ACA text and the subsequent regulations said the intention of the ACA text was not that this was a budget-neutral program. And in fact, you are obligated, the federal government is obligated to make these payments. If this, as the rest of these 12 cases work their way through the Federal Court of Appeals, you're going to have to reconcile those opinions, and this probably starts to move forward to the Supreme Court. This becomes a really difficult issue, but it's become less political. It'll become more judicial as we get further down the line in the interpretation of the text. The other data point, though, I just want to point you to, which is, and I don't know how public this is, so I'm going to parse my words really carefully. But there was a co-op in the state of Maryland that did something no other co-op has done just yet. They basically found a path out of CMS. So they worked with their state to work out a for-profit conversion. So they changed their tax status from a 501c29 to being for-profit. And then they worked a deal to basically buy out their debt on a discounted basis. They then went out and got an investor, and that investor brought some capital to that transaction, bought the debt out. And part of that transaction was that Evergreen would drop its claim for that risk corridor funding. That was part of the financial mechanism for this. And you can almost interpret that as CMS kind of making a de facto payment of the risk corridor money to a plan. Now, I don't know if that shows up in the judicial process here, but that's not insignificant because it shows that there is some penchant on the side of CMS to use these dollars on a policy basis. Which is a long way of saying I have no idea and I can't answer the question for your leadership, but it's got a lot of attention and there could be a favorable outcome on this.
The other question is just, you know, a lot of us do risk adjustment on the ACA side. If you looked in your crystal ball, what should we prepare for, plan for? I've got an underwriting department that's all freaking out that they're going to need to hire more underwriters because they think the individual and small group is not going to be part of that anymore. So just look, what would you...
Not be part of the risk adjustment.
Yeah, the way they'd have to underwrite because it wouldn't be, you know, how it is currently. And so I guess my question is you know, my thought is, we'll just hang tight, we just do what we're doing because nothing has been done. But can you kind of foreshadow, what do you expect to happen in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years?
So because you're hitting parts of my comments, I'm just going to take a minute and give you a longer answer to that, and then I'm going to check that box in my remarks. If you think, and just the quick historical context, if we go back a year ago, I had a client that had a meeting with Andy Slavitt, and they went into the meeting and they said, Administrator Slavitt, risk adjustment's a big problem, and they laid out the evidence, and they showed the estimation bias and why the fixed admin fee was inappropriate and all of the other things that people, you know, needs pharmacy claims data. And Andy Slavitt said, look, risk adjustment program is fine. It's working as intended. You're crazy. Anybody that thinks it's wrong is crazy. And if you want to go careening into this brick wall, be my guest, but you're going to hit a brick wall. We're not changing anything. And then we went to March. And in March, we had this forum and this white paper. And it was the first time that CMS kind of publicly said, yeah, there might be some flaws. And then we went into this interim final rule late last year that said, okay, look, maybe there's some flaws. We can't do much about it right now, and anything we can do is going to take time. So states, we're not going to get in the way. If you want to kind of do a post-transfer adjustment, we need to probably bless it, but you can go ahead and do that if you need to do something in your state to promote the viability of your markets. And then we saw the proposed notice of benefit and payment parameters, where they went a step further, and they said, okay, partial year enrollment, and we're going to look at the estimation bias issue, and we're going to think about including pharmacy claims data. Well, they did all of that in the final, as you all know, and then they added one more thing, which wasn't in the proposed rule. They took care of this issue of the fixed admin fee in the statewide average premium part of the formula, and that was kind of a last-minute decision that Jeff Wu and others kind of promoted. I think on December 31st, after all of that activity, all of this derision, you were getting it from Anthem, you were getting it from Aetna, you were getting it from Molina, you were getting it from Choices. We were part of this work with Jeff Wu and others. Everybody took a step back. In fact, I remember being on the phone with one of the most, the loudest Blue Cross Blue Shield player that just thought the formula was totally wrong. And they said, you know, we're actually pretty satisfied with the changes. We still have some issues, but we're not going to make a big deal of it right now. I give you that historical context because walking into 2018, I think CMS feels that for the moment they've resolved some of those more substantive technical concerns with the model. That may or may not be true, but that's going to be the feeling they're going to have. And because so much of the policy oxygen right now, you know, last year, I mean, risk adjustment was one of the most interesting things going on. That kind of tells you how like boring the health policy environment was. Coming into this year, it's not going to get a lot of immediate attention. Yesterday, Dr. Molina came out and said, this is a problem. And if he saber rattles and others start to saber rattle, you could see a change. So if you look in a crystal ball and you go forward a bit, you've got to reconcile two things. You've got to reconcile the existing statutory framework of the Affordable Care Act and the administration's legal responsibility to implement it? And are there changes they can make to the risk adjustment formula within the confines of that statute that make it better and make the markets function better? I don't think we're going to see that for a little bit. I think acting as you have been and moving forward and assuming no change is probably the prudent course. On the other side of that, though, you have the congressional activity, which we just talked through. And if in the course of a sidecar or other legislation, you saw changes to the risk adjustment program, which would have to be induced by a pretty significant advocacy effort from the plans and the community, then maybe you would see some changes. But I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing the Blues. It's a hard thing for the Blues and AHIP and others to kind of go drive because all their members are affected differently. So for the moment, I would say it's a bit status quo. Question back here, and then we'll come. Actually, is yours related to the risk adjustment?
Yes.
Is yours related to the risk adjustment?
Yes, and you largely answered it.
What's that? I already answered it? Okay, you look good with the microphone anyway.
Okay, mine is more on the RADV side of the risk adjustment.
Yeah.
You know, this last year was a practice year for plans.
Yeah.
CMS originally said they were going to have two, but, you know, they were running behind, so the first year just kind of got waylaid, and they had the practice year last year. And as we went through it, they kind of did everything on the fly and made up stuff, changed it around, did whatever they needed to. And I know there were people asking, were they going to be able to have a second practice year so we could get best practices and also find out what we did wrong the first year because those results aren't even out. And so is there any pressure going that way to have another practice year on it?
Not that I have seen, but I'll tell you I'm also not hanging out in those circles at the immediate moment. What I'll do is I'll ping a couple of folks that I know in town and see if they're hearing anything. I'll pass that back along to Kathy and Dennis, who can share it with you. I'm not hearing anything, but that doesn't mean there's not pressure.
Okay, thank you.
And then, Sean, and then I'll bring you in.
Just briefly, I've seen a lot of the changes that CMS has made to the risk adjustment program in response to a lot of the critiques. I wasn't aware that Dr. Molina critique the risk adjustment yesterday. I don't know if you could elaborate a little bit about any particular reasons he gave and if you think there's going to be any traction or impact with these continued critiques of the risk adjustment program.
So I still have I still need to listen to the earnings call. All I've read is a blurb and a quote. You might recall last year, Dr. Molina walked through a risk adjustment 101 for investment analysts. That's how serious they took this. My guess is he probably referenced it. I don't know how deep he went in. Did you hear the earnings call at all, Sean?
I didn't hear the earnings call. Just a couple comments on his question and probably your question, deep in this, of course. But in terms of...
Oh, sorry, talking to the mic.
I'm just holding it out here.
So we're on. But, in terms of... I think Molina, we talked about this morning, to some degree is piling on. And it gets to the issue that I think is somewhat still at hand, which is there an acceptance, and CMS is to some degree acknowledges that there's still a sort of a bias to the risk adjustment formula, particularly those that are lower cost health plans that feel to some degree because it's the risk adjustment is based on a statewide average, that if you're significantly below the lowest cost, you're actually paying in a much higher portion of your premium. Thus, plans like Molina that try to be, once again, sort of slimmed down, more Medicaid type, products that, they still feel there's a bias. So I would also actually touch on the gentleman's question in terms of expected changes. If there were no major change to the benefit standards, then I would say most health plans recognize we're probably not going to see a big change to risk adjustment because, once again, over the last year, as David mentioned, I can tell you, and we were knee-deep in this a year ago, no way I would even bet. I think in, best-case scenario, we'd be where we were today. We just really we thought there'd be minor changes and at best case, major changes for 2019. So, quite frankly, most plans were surprised how far we got. The big but here, though, is if there are changes to the benefit standards or age banding, once again, that allows for 4-5-to-1, that limits, the essential health benefits. Once again, all those essentially are functioning to allow lower cost health plans. And as we just talked about, if there's a concern for bias against low cost health plans and risk adjustment, and you enable regulation that allows even lower cost health plans. We don't know what's going to happen, but there is legitimate concern that risk adjustment will even be that much more biased because of it. So it is something to watch for, right? So this is the scary thought, and this is the tough thing. to some degree, there are a few that say, we're okay with risk adjustment right now, but man, don't forget about it. Because if you do enact these changes in regulations and, you know, allow HSA gigantic $20,000 deductible health plans that cost you $100 a month, are you going to be paying $90 in risk adjustment on those? So, once again, is that going to be that much worse? So I think recognizing that, that's where risk adjustment could be affected.
And just to round out, Dr. Molina is kind of the only person that's really gone on the record. And we're just about done with managed care earnings season. In fact, I can't think of anybody else that's up on the docket. So I think at the moment, that's probably where we are. You could see more talk about this in the coming weeks. HHS, CMS, career staff, they feel it when people leave the market and people saber rattle like this. There's been a lot of saber rattling. They take it pretty seriously. And I can tell you that in the course of over the last year working on this issue with Jeff Wu in particular, who's kind of the acting interim CSIO director, he really wants to get this right. And he really is listening to the full range of opinion on this. So I think you've got it. I think there's an ear there.
Give him a raise.
What's that? Give him a raise. He's, I don't know if any of you have interacted with him. He's fantastic. He really is. He deserves a raise. Other questions, comments, observations right up here. We'll get you a mic.
So I'm going to move to Medicare Advantage. We just received the advance notice. We understood that it was very conservative. Not a lot of changes.
Yeah.
Now price is in. What are you guys feeling with the final?
Probably remains conservative. I think for this first year, you probably see more changes in subsequent years. As you know, and probably what you're alluding to, Tom Price is going to be interested in moving this 31% MA penetration rate up higher. And using, if we know, so kind of going back to the core political structure, if we can kind of assume there's not going to be any major structural changes to Medicare, there might be some funding cuts, then really Medicare reforms come through the administration, and it comes through either Medicare Advantage to try and drive away more reliance on fee-for-service, or it comes through MACRA implementation and either accelerating commercial recognition of alternative payment models or putting out Republican-based alternative payment models a la next-gen ACO. But I think initially, I probably would say the proposed rule is a reasonable indicator of the final. I don't know exactly, though. Okay, I'm going to check in. I'm just going to see what else I have to cover here, and then we'll run into any other questions or any thoughts. I've got a question for you all. We talked a little bit about the high-risk pools. Reinsurance payments, as I said a little earlier, we don't see there being a non-payment of reinsurance at this point. That seems to be stable, that program. We'll finish running out the clock. We talked about risk adjustments thanks to risk corridors, thanks to our friend Jason. And we talked a little bit about risk adjustment. Just a couple of other things to maybe cover in the policy environment. We just talked Medicare, Medicaid. I talked a little bit about some of the changes we would see there. And one of the things the administration, the Congress will have to do is kind of resolve this donut hole issue that we have with non-expansion states and the subsidy structure. We would probably see that addressed congressionally. But again, no block granting, leaving money on a stump in the woods for Republican or Democratic governors and running their own programs. Only other thing I'll say just about Medicaid is that the CMS administrator that begun her confirmation hearing today, Seema Verma, she's a Medicaid expert. She's a wonk. She drove the Healthy Indiana 2.0, which is probably the most conservatively progressive Medicaid program we've seen cost sharing for beneficiaries, some degree of continuous enrollment requirements and others. We would anticipate significant flexibility. If we're not doing anything to significantly change the financing structure for Medicaid, the benefit structure and the administration structure could get changed by states through waivers. And you could see a degree of flexibility come through CMS vis-a-vis 1115, 1332 waivers, and a series of other waivers that actually get you to a really flexible program that almost might look block grant-esque. So that's what I'd add on Medicaid. Individual market we've talked a little bit about. And the only other thing I'll just reference, and then I think I'll pause and we'll round this out, is payment delivery system reform. and all the stuff that we've seen over the last few years. You obviously, really since Secretary Burwell made this these goals in the New England Journal of Medicine of 30% value-based reimbursement by 2016, 50% by 2018, you saw Andy Slavitt and Dr. Conway just hit the gas, and they threw a ton of the mandatory bundles got thrown out at the market. You had CPC Plus, which is a kind of risk-adjusted variant on a P4P program, get thrown out. The next generation ACO model. Several other things that kind of came into the market. And then you had macro, which kind of sits underneath all of that. And there is a feeling on the side of Republicans and on the side of Secretary Price that physicians are just overwhelmed and they need to tap the brakes a little bit. They need to reconcile all of the alternative payment model stuff that's come out in the market, and they need to give the private sector a chance to lead. So I think you're going to see a few things here. Number one, I think you're going to see the Congress change the authority of CMMI. They're going to give them a little bit more transparency, and they're going to change their budget. So CMMI can't kind of drive that effort as quick and as hard as they need to or want to. You'll see Secretary Price pull back on some of the programs. We talked about mandatory. He needs to kind of figure out where the baseline is for how physicians are reading these. Number three, changes to the implementation of MACRA. And number four, I think you could finally start to see some congressional changes to stark and anti-kickback provisions that kind of prevent the commercial sector from driving value-based reimbursement in a way that's that might be more consistent with their interests and objectives. So I think a general slowing of what we've seen with payment delivery system reform stuff, but that might not be a bad thing right now. Yeah.
You mentioned reinsurance, and I also kind of wanted to talk about cost share reduction subsidies as well. But if reinsurance is underfunded, then do you think they'll still pay out at 50% even if they only receive cash enough to pay out at 45% or 40%? And then the second question on cost share reduction subsidies is, what is the likelihood that they go away in a sort of swift manner, right? Because we run out of cash in basically 90 days if cost share reduction subsidies go away, because it represents such a massive amount of premium. I mean, it is really, truly incredible when you model it out just to see it. Those advanced payments are critical to us, you know, continuing. So what is the chance that something happens where cost share reduction subsidies leave quickly? And then sort of a secondary follow-up to that is, what's the chance that they go away at all? You know, going away quickly is a disaster for us, but going away at all, you can kind of price it in, assuming the subsidies adjust. So
I'll go back just to a couple of the opening statements, which is we have not seen immediate action. The administration could have they could have done what they wanted. They could have pulled the plug on this pretty rapidly, and they didn't. We are anticipating no immediate, imminent changes to the prospective payouts of CSRs and of reinsurance. We fully expect those to be funded at this point, fully funded. Even if they're right, the statutory and regulatory commitments that have been made by the Congress and the administration, and again, I would credit a ton of advocacy or lobbying organizations for a lot, but really the health insurance lobby did a lot of really good work really early on, and I don't know to what degree they modeled it, but they demonstrated that any changes to either reinsurance or CSRs would unravel the market quickly, and there was a political calculus made that's a bad thing. So I'd be interested. Yeah, Kathy, and then, well, I'm going to just tee up. Well, the mic's going back to Kathy. I'm just ask you a question while we've got a few more minutes to go. I'm just interested in how you're all reading the environment. Joseph, if I call you Joseph, just shared that it would be major changes there would be a disaster for your plan as you started to model this out. But as you all are thinking about pricing, or you're making observations and making business decisions in this environment, what's weighing most heavily on you, and what's keeping you up at night? I'd be really interested in your thoughts there. So Kathy, and then we'll come right over here.
What I was interested in your comments, that over the last few years or when ACA passed, we saw a lot more provider-owned plans either expand their product lines or start up, and there's some projections about even more providers getting into the health plan business. And part of that's from taking on risk and then moving up. I'd just be interested, since most of the plans in here are part of that model, Do you see that being strengthened as things go forward, or you see barriers being put there and sort of the challenges that this particular type of plans would have in the market?
I don't see active impediments, but I see market forces slowing that sentiment a little bit. Two big market forces. I think the fact that neither of these mergers made it through is actually a pretty big deal. So I was anticipating that if the Aetna, Humana, Anthem, Cigna mergers happened, that would tee off a cascading series of events that would ultimately result in more provider-sponsored health plans to preserve market leverage. I think the fact that that didn't happen slows the impetus for that just a little bit. And then again, on the payment delivery system reform side, if you believe the assumption that CMS activity to promote risk bearing on the side of providers through payment slows down a bit, that slows down that sequencing. And there was also, I guess, the third and final is there was a lot of exuberance about this, you know, a few years ago, this notion of, well, we'll become an ACO and then we'll take a capitated payment and then, hey, hop, skip, and a jump, we'll take a premium. And I think providers have kind of started to realize going down this path that, well, it's really not that easy. Some have made it, but you've done it, I think, at a cost. And I think even those in this room that are provider-sponsored plans would probably acknowledge it's not as simple as just flipping a switch and taking risk.
So I think that leads to the next one, which is compliance. So if you look at the regulatory requirements for smaller plans, it looked like, especially with the Aetna, Humana, Cigna, Anthem, all those mergers, when they were going, it was pushing towards consolidation of the market and really regulating the small plans out of the market.
Yeah.
So now that that doesn't happen, do you think it goes back the other way, where smaller plans will have more incentives to compete in the market or be... the regulatory requirements will be lessened, which kind of the administration's point of view, right? Reduce regulation. How do you think that dynamic? Because that they're really the compliance issues are forcing smaller plans out of the market as it exists today.
Yeah. Well, so obviously different shades to that question. There's state compliance, which I won't speak to broadly, but that obviously changes from state to state. Federal compliance, I think you're right. There's a disposition on the side of the administration to lower the burden. That also starts to get a bit deeper into the policy level details for an administration or a Congress that I just don't know how much attention that gets at the moment. I think the fact, though, that there's an acknowledgement on the side of regulators, and this is a pretty big deal, especially because neither side decided to relitigate and put the Trump DOJ on notice that they had to put a stake in the ground. At the moment, the baseline for regulators is that they've defined what insurance market competitiveness means, both for MA and for ASO. I think it's still not a totally attractive thing for a venture capitalist to go underwrite an Oscar to jump into the market, especially right now with some of the uncertainty. But I think that those barriers to entry have been lessened a bit by virtue of both the non-merger activity and the disposition of the Trump White House on regulations. So I don't think it's unreasonable that you'll see more Melodies or Brights or others, but Oscar's kind of paving the way, and that's been an expensive lesson for venture capitalists and what works and what doesn't work here. And again, turns out building a health plan from scratch, not an easy thing to do. We've seen it with Oscar. We've seen it with the co-ops. Different circumstances, but that'd be my thought. Yeah. I'm sorry. Actually, let me go. I think he was next, and then we'll get right back to you.
Will, you had asked for some of our reading of the tea leaves, so I thought I'd share a few things. All in the individual space, going to be brief. I don't have time to elaborate my reasons. But one, as time goes on, I feel more and more confident plunging ahead, pricing for 2018, using the market rules as is. I think the window for them to make changes to 2018 is gone. I think the regulations that came out yesterday, well, there's nothing to say with certainty. If I was a betting man, I'd say those are going to be the last changes. And as we know, they're changes, but they're not, you know, super huge changes. I feel very confident that the imminent threat of the CSRs going away is no longer there. And as you said, we saw strong action by AHIP. I also feel that making changes through the reconciliation process, I'm not confident it's going to happen for 2018 because any change that they make that has a budget piece is going to lead to instability, and so the political fallout is going to be too great. And so that combined with all of the gridlock and the different opinions we're seeing and the distraction with the Flynn and Russian stuff, I really think that the market rules as are going to remain for 2018. Personally, for us, we've not been profitable in individual space 14 through 16. We believe we're going to return to profitability in 16, and we have optimistic projections for 2018 initially. So I'm personally optimistic from the standpoint of ourselves, and I personally wouldn't mind it if some of the nationals get out and then we wouldn't be able to take their market share.
Those are great observations, helpful to hear that. One of the things you hit on, I think, is really important is the timing for all of this, and that if you didn't really have a major bill pass until the end of this year or early next year, then you go through the rulemaking process. I mean, you really could be looking at plan year 2020 effectuation. So this is, we're going to steady the ship. Sean, you were going to say something, and then I'll come right back to you.
Dean, appreciate the thoughts, because actually I'm really going to pick up where you just left off, and it gets a little bit, this gentleman's comments about what's happened now. And the one thing I don't think we have mentioned, which everybody also knows about and recognizes, Humana's exit creates a lot of regions, and we've actually just been doing this analysis this week and probably trying to put out a little white paper blog post on a later about this, but essentially a lot of counties and regions may very well have zero players playing it just next year, right? And we saw this happen in Arizona where the state tries to step in, regulators try to step in, and, you know, frankly, negotiations take place where they probably do curry some favors with health plans to get them to compete and enter a market so there is somebody there. Humana covers a lot of markets, and their exit is not likely going to be overtaken by one other single national health plan. We know they're not going to, you know, no national health plan is going to jump in and cover a bunch of markets. So in terms of the opportunity for smaller provider-sponsored health plans or regional health plans, whether they're provider-sponsored or not, we would contend there is a potential upside there for them, right? If you're a small provider health plan in a market where you know there's no competition anymore and your state wants somebody to offer health insurance coverage, there's an opportunity. You know, you would, you know, obviously you're leveraged to some degree to say, hey, make sure we get paid for this. And frankly, we've seen it in Minnesota. Another, I mean, there's so much going on. Reason why, once again, we can't have slides because this thing's changing by the day. But you see the state in Minnesota, they've stepped in and said, you know what, we need to provide more subsidies for our market. I can tell you, it totally took us off by guard. We couldn't believe the state is coming in and just throwing more subsidy dollars because just to shore up their own market. Once again, you can envision, say like Mississippi, Humana covers that whole state. No other carrier covers that. The Blue Cross plan doesn't even play on the exchange there, right? So I can tell you, there's a state right there that's probably looking around for somebody to come help them out. So I once again, I think the upside, a lot of downside to Humana exiting. Doesn't look good for the market, right? It's kind of leaves a bad taste in everybody's mouth. It's unfortunate. These guys were committed from day one. There is potential opportunities there, though, I would say.
I'll push back on that a little bit because your assumption is it's possible to make money. And the last 3 years have shown unprecedented bleeding of profit amongst the entire industry to the point where the recognized industry experts, United Health Group, has pulled out and has pulled out. Humana has pulled out. The only ones seem to be making money are Centene, Molina, the types that have subverted the original purpose of the ACA and turned it into a Medicaid Plus, and kudos to them. But that's only covering a small portion of the population it was meant to cover. So anyway, but I appreciate your comments, you know, just my opinion. But my question to you was, how big of a say is the industry going to have in the direction of reform? Because I think this administration needs to sell the industry that they can make money in whatever comes next. Because I think at this point the definitive answer is not many are making money now.
Yeah, so couple points. So to go back just on something Sean had shared and some analysis we've done, you are unequivocally correct when you state that over the last few years everybody's lost money. Sans Centene and a few blues here and there. Yeah, no, I know, and I know you guys feel this. We've also, as we've modeled this out longitudinally, the loss has been lessened a bit each year, and you'd expect that, right? Because we're finally kind of learning how to price a little bit better. We're getting some predictability, not perfect predictability. But we're also dealing with a fundamentally, and it's obviously different from rating area to rating area, but you're dealing with kind of a flawed pool, which goes back to kind of a flawed structure in the law itself. So that creates two dynamics. It creates an erosion of confidence in the market mechanics that allow a health plan to generate a profit, and it promotes the erosion of confidence in the federal government. And I think that's why you're seeing this saber rattling. And I think what you're really seeing is we have lost the confidence in the federal government to administer this program as is required, and we have lost the confidence by extension of the market to operate in a way that allows us to be profitable. So to your point, this becomes a critical exercise for the administration and the Congress to listen to industry. And it can't really, you know, again, I give BCBSA and AHIP and others huge credit for the work that they've done. But I've said several times around D.C., it's got to be those plans that are making the go-no-go decisions, because ultimately you're the ones that are participating and you're taking the financial risk. So I think there's a desire and a disposition to listen, and there are efforts around town to organize bodies that would promote that in a better way. It's a critical component. I think you're absolutely right. Okay. Are you ready?
I'm
ready.
Ready
yet?
Yeah, okay. I've been working on it for a while. I guess two things. Like one of the things that I've been looking at, I'll just speak for myself, but is as the national carriers exit, you know, realizing that the subsidy math is hackable if you're the only carrier on there, because if you can get a big enough spread between the lowest cost silver and the second lowest cost silver, you can have, you know, for folks who are between, you know, 100 and 300% FPL, you can have, the plans can be so cheap, because if you've got like a $100 spread between the lowest and the second lowest, there's huge opportunity there. And that's one of the things that I'm wondering, you know, if there are lots of exits and lots of monopoly carriers in the market, there's opportunity to just, you know, raise your rates a lot. But most of the consumers, aside from the unsubsidized folks who will be hurt, but most consumers don't feel the impact of it. We saw that in a small way in our market, where we went from having between 4 and 5 competitors to just us and Blue Cross, and we raised rates 25%. But on average, our subsidized members only saw about a 1% to 2% decrease in their net premium on average. And so we tripled our market share, or not our market share, we tripled our membership in the places that we play. And so I wonder, I think there's some opportunity there to really leverage, you know, if there's not an individual mandate or not a strong one, if you can just make the product attractive to people, you don't need a mandate. If it's cheap, you know, I don't need a mandate to spend $10 a month on health insurance if that's what it does, if it's a attractive plan because it's CSR. The other thing that I wonder about is on, you know, these risk corridor lawsuits and the CSR and all that, if there's any sense that, you know, the administration wants to work with the insurance industry, and if they don't eventually, you know, pay up on their promises, that the industry may not be willing to trust the administration or trust that the government is going to fulfill its promises because they, you know, they broke their promises on risk corridors.
So I heard an observation in the first. Couldn't tell if there was a question.
Yeah,
in the
it was just a question. If there is any sense that's part of what's maybe driving this. Okay, maybe we don't kill CSR on day one. Maybe we fund reinsurance. Maybe we try to work with the industry, because if we don't work with them on the promises that were made under the previous administration, they're not going to trust that promises made by the government are meaningful.
Yeah. You know? And, well, it's look. I think they're great observations. It's a great question. I think it goes back partially to what the comments that you made. It's critical, at least at this point, that confidence is restored. You know, one of the things I've been interested just to observe so far is, you know, health plans have typically, you've kind of held the place pharma holds right now. You're usually the one that's vilified from the bully pulpit as scamming consumers and making obscene amounts of profits for the things that you do, and you, those were the good old days. But that narrative hasn't really come back at this point. And at this point, I think the industry, and I think I like the way you termed it, the industry is registering dissent with the way things are being done, and they're doing it and on Wall Street primarily through these earnings events, but. I think that is putting the government on notice that we are a material part of whatever you do And if it's not done correctly, or we don't have confidence that, that we can pay our bills by virtue of honoring your commitments, we can't continue to participate in that way. So it's a critical component. I know that that's not lost, I think, on the Congress. I don't think it's lost on the administration, but there's a lot we need to see over the next few weeks. So hey, Dennis knew you were going to add something, so he was standing behind you with the mic.
Dennis and I know each other. Just to build on that trust issue, I feel like winners and losers in the healthcare delivery system are sort of being picked and chosen. Hospitals are always crying how hard they have it, yet their community benefit expenditures are having hard time finding place for that charity money to go. Like if you're a large nonprofit, look at modern healthcare, they're all whining. It's like, you know, I've got nowhere to put my charity money anymore because we're so awash in cash. You know, I've got no charity care, not no, but, you know, my charity care walking in the door has just plummeted because it's all transitioned to the ACA. So big winner, hospitals across the board for the most part. Pharmaceutical companies, obviously, big winner. Who's kidding who, right? So you got one of the historical big winners. The insurance industry is now the loser. How much of a beating do you think we're going to have to take, you know, before the cycle turns around again?
Well, there's a lot packed in that. I probably can't respond to all of it. I will say I'll leave pharma out of it because I think that's just a whole separate. And I'd even actually isolate PBMs as kind of being the point of focus and where you've got some potential savings that you can inure. I'd say for hospitals, and I'm not going to do an ardent defense or prosecution against anybody, but hospitals, for their part, really did stand up with the rest of the industry, and they championed in good faith the ACA, and they did it on the basis of expanded coverage and lower uncompensated care. And what hospitals have faced is dish cuts in the face of non-expansion. They face non-expansion. No, but we haven't. We've seen 33% of what the CBO thought we'd see in the individual market, and we've seen huge pressure on the rev cycle because of the high cost of deductibles, which has made it harder. And so it's actually, when you look on an aggregate basis, the hospital industry didn't get a great deal here. Now, you can talk charity care and a litany of other things, but I would say hospitals are very much in this camp with payers in that they've lost confidence in this process and that they've taken a bit of a beating in parts of this because of the financial mechanisms. I think at the end of the day, political ownership is going to shift on an ideological basis. And when it shifts to a different ideology that's embodied by a party, you're going to look for them to deflect back to somebody else. And that's where you start to see fingers being pointed at industry. And I don't know where health plans and the health insurance industry would be in that timeline. Right now, pharma's a bit easier because there's very populist undertones to Martin Shkreli or EpiPen or other notions. And at the moment, health plans, you can't find those stories. But if Republicans pursue a policy route and health plans don't participate, you will start to see more of that narrative. And I'd be prepared for that. Thanks. Well, really quick, did you want to make a comment on
just
that?
And then just quickly add, and I tell you, we have this conversation all the time, and we're, you know, once again, I would say conversations and perceptions are extremely important. Right, we just talked about what perceptions of the hospital industry. I would say what's also hurting the perception of the insurance industry, and you see in articles all the time, the stock price of the largest health insurance companies in this country have doubled since the ACA came into play. And I have this conversation all the time with people. Once again, more, you know, your average Joe sitting on the airplane, it's like, oh, isn't this great for the insurance or loving him? Like, no, they're not, right? Nobody in this room is happy about, you know, financially the results from the ACA. But from a public standpoint, when, once again, most people just sort of look to the big companies they've heard of, and they look at their stock price and say, oh, look what the ACA has done for them, that's what's tricky. And I would say, I think even a lot of policymakers sort of felt that, like, oh, you guys are making money hand over foot, and they're recognizing now, oh, you're not. And you're actually, when you say you're an exit market, you really might exit the market. This isn't a joke. And so that, I think, once again, those communications are still happening.
And just one other quick on that, and we'll come over here. This coming back to our risk corridors, this whole notion of budget neutrality was raised by a Republican senator who basically decried the bailout of the insurance industry, which we know is a fallacious point of view. But nevertheless, that kind of those point issue populist-based rhetoric, that you could start to see that creep back in depending on what the Congress does and how the insurance industry responds.
So I understand the hesitancy to really get into pharma and PBM, so I'll ask a close-ended question. do we have hope with in regard to reprieve from some of the ridiculousness of, you know, just pharma as it is in general pricing, you know, all this pipeline, out of control cost? Just yes or no. You don't have to go into great deal. Because I do also want to know about CMMI, and is there big things coming, more mandatory type things? We're a facilitator convener for our health system for the BPCI.
Okay. So. Yeah, I'll comment on both. I'll be a little I'll just dance around the first one just for a second, which is not probably hard to do because I don't think we know a lot. You saw out of both political campaigns, and then you saw Donald Trump make good on that expression to put pressure on the drug industry to lower its prices. And you saw some drug companies respond to that in the early days of the administration. You know, the generic version of the EpiPen it was an example of this. And I think they recognize that they're on notice. This becomes a question of what happens with policy. And at the moment, I think there's kind of a stable baseline. But you either have things that drive price fixing, price setting, or price transparency on a policy level, or you're just calling attention to it. And I think right now we're still on the calling attention to it. The meeting with pharma at the White House. I think you could see some congressional hearings. You saw this last year again with Martin Shkreli and some others. The moment where you have another blockbuster drug hit the market, the moment where somebody makes a movie about somebody who passed away because they couldn't afford a life-saving medication, and these things happen. This is how you shift public opinion. When these things begin to happen again, It will touch back the nervous system of this administration and kick them into gear. I don't think you're going to see anything over on the price-setting side. I think you'll see scrutiny. I think you'll see PBMs be a bit of a point of focus on this. But I think it's kind of a stable environment right now, which I know is not what you want to hear about. CMMI, I would just expect at the moment a bit of an all-stop. I wouldn't worry about BPCI. And Dr. Conway, by the way, I think there's problems kind of with the financing and the reconciliation under Model 2 and Model 3. Some of the awardee conveners have started making that case, particularly on the ortho side. Signatures, Juan Remedy, I think, has said things. NaviHealth. So I think there's a desire to kind of fix any structural methodological problems with the data and the program. I don't know that I'd expect a doubling down on it or a major expansion for several months or a year. So stay the course on BPCI.
Regarding the employer mandate, is there any buzz about maybe making that a sidecar issue? Because it seems like, on the surface, it seems like something that could easily be repealed and not totally impact the industry immensely. But I don't know how much of a influence the smaller businesses have in Congress right now.
I think you'd see this in the big tent. Repeal, replace through reconciliation. The employer mandate goes away, and there's pay for. It's going to cost the Congress something to repeal that. But I don't even know that there's kind of bipartisan consensus around that, around the Cadillac tax, around medical device tax, to remove those from the framework. And you wouldn't need to kind of embed them in sidecar. So I think you could see that in the big event. Thought I saw one other hand.
I'm curious, Ed, if you know, you mentioned profitability in the ACA markets, and I realize I'm probably the only one in here that's like, yay, ACA markets. I think part of the
somebody's going to jump you after this.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to get beat up in the hallway. I know. I'm curious, would you have been profitable if Risk Corridors had actually paid out the way it was supposed to be? If Risk Corridors was paid out the way that it was initially supposed to be? I mean, I think part of the problem in the first few years is just that everyone made assumptions that you found out after the fact weren't true. Yeah. I mean, in 2015, we would have made money as a company, even though we took a huge loss on our exchange business, if Risk Corridors had paid out in 2015.
So we were profitable in 2014.
So are we.
Which was an awesome experience. But then, you know, the one I miss. But I think what's happened is first of all, the answer to the risk corridors is no, because by definition, risk corridor only covers, you know, a certain, you know, percentage, 50 to 80% of your losses. So unless you're in other business lines, you know, I don't think it would be possible for a risk corridor to make you profitable, although I certainly hope to get it one day. But to quote, you know, Bertolini, right? Yeah, I think that we've created a death spiral, especially once if we're going to eliminate the individual mandate, which I think is effectively eliminated because the IRS doesn't seem to have an interest in following up on it.
My question is given what a lot of this comes down to is everyone mispriced very badly, right? So in counties where you've seen that there is no player and there has to be some negotiation on behalf of the carrier, and I'm asking this because I don't know, how much leeway have carriers gotten to come in the market and just jack rates like 40-50%? I mean, because at some point you can make money, right? Because the subsidies are covering so much of the cost for the consumer, they don't even see it. It's still $20 product for them. The federal government's paying $900. Who cares? So how much of that do you see in the markets where they've had to have essentially a bailout by somebody?
Yeah, so it's a function of politics, data, and technical sophistication of the DOI and the ability to understand what's happening in the market and what kind of drives that. We've seen flexibility, and we've seen an allowance for that. And there's states that have initially been very draconian in their viewpoint for rate increases, and when they get in with the data and they really start to scrutinize what's happening in the market, they soften that. But it changes from state to state, and it's obviously not going to be an attractive thing if you're an elected commissioner and you're the steward of 40-50% rate increases. I think to your point, and the discussion you guys will take offline later, is that everybody did misprice the market for two reasons. One, didn't really have much of a precedent for an individual market without medical underwriting, and two, the government didn't necessarily fulfill its obligations. And so you've had to adjust for that on the fly. That's why we do longitudinally see margins and losses decreasing and margins slowly starting to normalize a bit and pricing slowly normalizing. But we're still working our way to that point. And now we're doing it in an environment where everything's become a bit uncertain again, which makes it difficult. And that's why you're seeing the derision we're seeing.
The question is around transitional policy. So I heard on an internal call earlier this week, I have no idea where it came from, that there may be some word on the street that transitional policies are going to be extended. So I'm just curious if that's a reality. As we are trying to price, and I agree with Joseph, I think that you can price at least better now than you used to be able to. But this idea of transitional market and if that's going to stick around, that's going to have a huge impact in some markets. It's going to be really huge. You know, what does happen to the risk adjustment pool if those transitional policies go away? And if the IRS is doing what they say they're going to be doing with the individual mandate going away, you know, the health plans are going to be held to, you know, what they can offer. So what happens to that population and how much of them enter the ACA market? So those are my questions for you, as well as, you know, what folks in the room think is going to happen.
I would just simply answer. We're hearing the same saber rattling. I would just observe that any changes, either extending or curtailing the transition policies, didn't end up in the proposed rule. That shouldn't be overlooked, because the administration could weigh in on this. They've chosen not to. They may have just not gotten to that level of depth. But this falls in the, if you like your plan, you can keep it, and Republicans not wanting to be caught with their without a seat on this if this becomes a political issue again. We've heard the same saber rattling. I would tell you that as a policy person, I think any responsible policy person that's watching this and observes some of the deleterious impacts this has had and could continue to have, they would just kind of step back from it and find a way to spin the narrative. But it's prevalent enough that it's on the table, and I'd keep an eye on it. I'd still give it lower probability. Sean, maybe last word from. Have you heard anything on this? Sorry.
Yeah, I think there's a. Once again, it goes back to this issue of flexibility. I think there's a good chance that they're gonna, you know, be very willing to be flexible on it, which I know from an actuarial standpoint and from a, you know, pricing standpoint, we would really like to get everybody in this one pool, but I think there's a high likelihood. That was my read of the tea leaves. I probably saw the same stuff you did. I would say, once again, if you want that flexibility, And that's what I was going with the Humana thing. By no means is my suggestion that Humana exiting is great for the market. I'm just suggesting it increases everybody else's leverage. It gives you guys a little more leverage, right? So if your health plan, and I know there are a few out there that still have a lot of sort of grandfathered transition plans, and I've talked to them, and they say, hey, I don't really want to move them. And guess what? You can now go back to your regulators and say, hey, look at all these exits. What's happening? You want me to really dump that product? That's, unfortunately, the position they're in.
Thanks, Sean. Kristen's taken now. Right.
What I'm curious, I've been listening to a lot of strategic webinars over the last 6 months from different consultants and wonks that are talking about, you know, where to place your bets, right? So if you're an organization that's, you know, ACA only, you launch in the exchanges and that's what you've been doing, and now there's all of this going on, how do you diversify? Or if you're a Medicaid only and you thought about going into the exchanges but you held back, well, now is it safe to make it or do you need to keep holding? What would you say to those leaders and those organizations that are wrestling with those types of decisions around portfolio diversification?
It's a great question. I think MA is a great market. It's a fairly safe market. You need to be prepared for a couple of years of losses and building up, and you need to watch the dynamics in your market. If the Aetna Humana thing had happened, oh, I would have told you, just start picking markets where you might be able to go in, and anything that shook. What I would have expected was divestitures required by the courts, and then you could have gone into Kansas City and swooped up a bunch of lives because of what was left over. MA is pretty safe. I think Medicaid, I think you're going to see more flexibility. I think that's good and bad. I think there's opportunities that you can make money over the coming years. I think there's tailwinds. Medicaid's not easy. And you need to be pretty good at managing care and populations to be in that market. And then obviously, you know, group funded coverage is probably the safest part in your portfolio. So if you're not operating deeply in ASO or larger group fully insured business, that's a good place to diversify.
This concludes this session. If you have any questions for David Smith, you can find his contact information on the speaker tab of the 2017 Risk Adjustment event page on the Health Plan Alliance website.